9. Ephesians 1, beginning of verse 9. We're talking about the purpose of the Almighty God, having made known unto us the mystery of his will, according to his good pleasure, which he hath purposed in himself. So here the Almighty has a purpose, that in the dispensation of the fullness of time, he might gather together in one all things in Christ, both which are in heaven and which are in earth, even in him, in whom also we have obtained an inheritance, being predestined according to the purpose of him who works all things after the counsel of his own will. So here is God determining all these things according to his purpose, and he works all things after the counsel of his will. So he works all things. Is there anything that is missed out? In Romans, the 8th chapter and verse 28, he tells us that there is an eternal purpose, and he is working all these things together for good for those who are called to his purpose. Verse 28, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them which are the called according to his purpose. So God calls men to his purpose. And the word church literally in the Greek means the called out ones. So he's calling us out of the world to fulfill his purpose. And we see in the beginning here, when God was creating the earth, that he saw that the wickedness of man was very great after about 1600 years. And so he began to work with those people that were still righteous, which is just one family, and that is Noah. And so when Noah then was righteous before God, he determined to destroy the world. So in Genesis, the 6th chapter, Genesis chapter 6, verse 1, it came to pass that when men began to multiply on the face of the earth and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. So here you have sons of God and you got daughters of men. It sounds like they don't match. And the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man, for he is also flesh. Yet his days shall be 120 years. Verse 4, there were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became the mighty men which were of old, men of renown. In verse 5, God saw the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the heart's thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And it repented the Lord that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him in his heart. Now, how many know this kind of God? It repented God, the Lord, that's the word Jehovah in the Hebrew, that he had made man in the earth, and it grieved him at his heart. And the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, and the creeping thing and the fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So God then decided to destroy this world with a flood. So in chapter 7, beginning in verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, in the second month, the second day, 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were open, and the rain that was upon rain was upon the earth 40 days and 40 nights. In the selfsame day entered Noah and Shem and Ham and Japheth, the sons of Noah, and Noah's wife, and the three wives of his children with them into the ark. Now the world today says these things didn't happen. And it's interesting that until 1850, almost everybody believed the history in the Bible. It's the only book that actually goes back as far as it does in history and names people even from the beginning of the creation, by date, by age, and how old they were when their sons were born. And so we can follow this all the way back to the very beginning. It's the only book in the world that's even beginning to be like that. The only other book in the world that is found before 1000 AD is the Hindu Rig Veda, which is not really a Bible, it's just songs to a god. And then the Upanishads, which were made about 2000 years later, but it doesn't purport to have anything, and it's just a bunch of songs. They follow it in history, and some of the history they can pick out, but most of it they can't. And there's no other book like it in the world. And so the Muslims have their Bible, and their Bible starts about 629 AD, so many years later. And the Bible is the only book that even begins to follow in chronological order for over 1500 years. So many say, well, this account of the flood is just something that we can't abide because there were no fountains under the earth like this. I'd like to read to you from a Wikipedia article and let you know what scientists now have discovered under the earth. All right, this is in time.com under subterranean ocean reservoir. It says the recent discovery of a subterranean sea deep inside the earth has scientists excited about the latter possibility. Like something out of the early 19th century playwright Jules Verne's novel, Journey to the Center of the Earth, in which characters stumble across a massive underground basin, a team of geologists led by Stephen Jacobson from the Northwestern University have found a vast body of water three times the size of any ocean located, any ocean that's on Earth today, located near the Earth's core. It's possible that water from this enormous reservoir oozed to the surface, and he's guessing on how these oceans came to be. Well, it's interesting that they found a vast body of water three times the size of any ocean located near the Earth's floor. They've also found that there's a rock down near the Earth's core called woodite. And that woodite is houses a great deal of water. And so this Earth has a massive amount of water. Well, as we go back in the history of the world, I'd like to mention here for just a moment that there's another article in Wikipedia talking about history and prehistory. And it starts out, the history of the world is the memory of past experience of Homo sapiens, and that's of course man, around the world, as that experience has been preserved largely in written records. Prehistory, historians mean the recovery of knowledge of the past in an area where no written record exists, or where the writing of a culture is not understood. So we can see then, the history of the world is witness of men. Writing is the only way to have witness of the distant past. Writing did not begin to describe any events until 2000 BC or later. Now, when the historians say writing, they're not talking about meaningful writing, and they define it. They say writing is any kind of mark whatsoever that we can find. And they guess that started about 3000 BC. But meaningful writing they call literature. And writing then began about 1000 years before this literature. And the literature they say was about 2000 BC. So two alphabets seem to begin about the same time in Sumer, which is Mesopotamia near Babylon, and Egypt. But China seemed to begin several hundred years later. So the earliest actual writing that we have, which they call literature, is in Sumer. And that's in the cuneiform, which is wedges. And they make the wedges by having soft clay and pressing wedges in different patterns. And then the soft clay then is put into an oven and burned and made hard. And we have many of those from Sumer now. Nobody could read them until about 1879. In 1879, they began to read one of these because the language was combined with four other languages, and so they were able to break the meaning of the cuneiform. All right, so meaningful literature then did not start until 2000 BC. So what do we know before 2000 BC? We really don't know anything. It takes man's witness to tell us what happened. We can guess with some of the materials that we have, but we really don't know the history of them. All right, the origin of writing, according to this article, appeared to start during the pottery phase. Well, then they tell about marks being made. But actual writing is first recorded in Uruk, which is this Ur of the Chaldees, where Abraham came from, at the end of the fourth millennium, about 3000 BC. And soon after in various parts of the Near East. But again, actual writing did not start until about 2000 BC. So what do we know then before that time? And of course, they guess that things are happening, but we have nothing to tie it to. So man's writing, so-called, only began in meaningful form about 2000 BC. Well, we have the scriptures then being written about 500 years after meaningful literature began, first in Egypt and in Sumeria. So then we have this writing then that Moses gave, and Moses began to write these things. And in Exodus 34, verse 27, Exodus 34, verse 27, and the Lord said unto Moses, write thou these words, for after the tenor of these words I have made a covenant with thee and with Israel. And then later in Exodus, the 24th chapter, verses 2 through 4, and Moses alone came near unto the Lord, but they shall not come nigh, neither shall the people go up with him. And Moses came and told the people all the words of the Lord, and all the judgments, and all the people answered with one voice and said, all the words which the Lord has said unto us, we will do. And Moses wrote all the words of the Lord, rose up early in the morning and built an altar under the hill, and the 12 pillars according to the 12 tribes of Israel. And then 40 years later, in Deuteronomy 31, verse 9, 40 years later, then they have three other books, Leviticus, and Numbers and Deuteronomy. Leviticus is rules for the priest. Numbers is the history of that 40 years. And Deuteronomy is five sermons at the end of Moses' life. So Deuteronomy 31, verse 9, and Moses wrote this law and delivered it unto the priests, the sons of Levi, which bear the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and unto all the elders of Israel. So we have a universal principle. Did Moses actually write these words? Men say, we don't believe it. Well, the question is, why not? And if we don't believe something, we need to have a reason if there are two witnesses. 2 Corinthians 13, verse 1. 2 Corinthians 13, verse 1. We have a universal principle that all courts observe even today. This is the third time I'm coming to you. In the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every word be established. All right, in Scripture, do we have any witnesses? Well, we got 66 books. It's not one book, it's 66. And we got 39 different witnesses, and many of them witness to each other. So 30 witnesses testify to each other. Moses and Joshua wrote at the same time. They lived at the same time. And the one testifies to the other. The prophets throughout Old Testament history from about 1200 through 400 BC all bear witness to each other. At least four apostles testify to the same miracles that the Old Testament prophets testify to, and they testify to each other. Then the apostles wrote the scriptures except for three books, that's Mark and Luke and Acts. The apostles then testified to Mark and Luke, and Mark and Luke testified to the apostles. So we don't have just writing scattered here and there. We have writings with witnesses. And all this history that the witnesses tell about dovetails with all the secular history that we find in the world today. So many of the things that are recorded in the scriptures, men said, well, that didn't happen. Later, they found out other secular books that said it did happen. So those who reject the witnesses must give a reasonable answer for not believing. Well, some say, well, there is no God. Well, that's interesting to know there is no God. How did we get here? They say evolution. We say, well, how did evolution occur? And they say, well, just little changes over millions and millions of years. And we say, where's your evidence? And we look in the geologic timetable. We don't find it. The geologic timetable has a sequence that is imaginary that's never been found in the earth. So where'd they get it from? Men imagined it. But we find every other different sequence of geology in the earth today. We also have fresh water-laid clay throughout the whole earth. You go anywhere in the world, you'll find these mountains with levels all the way through. Sometimes it dips down, but most of the time it's just level. And you ask yourself, how did that get there? Well, there's only one explanation that anyone's ever given that I know of, and that is that it's volcanic ash. We call it fresh water-laid clay that was in water that slowly but surely dried out. And we can find this sequence throughout the world. So where did all this volcanic ash come from? Well, we don't know, but it's there, and it's a mile and a half deep all over the world. How did it get there? Well, evolution doesn't record it. Evolution doesn't even begin to explain it. Where did life come from? Evolution imagines that. Here is a lightning bolt that hit some methane gas in a puddle, and cells began to multiply. Well, now that we find from DNA and all the things that are in the middle of that cell, we know that that's absolutely an impossible guess. Well, Darwin guessed that, but the research today says it's not happened. Each cell is a little manufacturing place with many different parts moving constantly and reestablishing DNA from RNA, which takes place outside the cell. And there's just no way that one cell could multiply without other things outside the cell called RNA that goes into the cell. Then the next question is, if man evolved, where did mind come from? Well, you look all over the place and find anybody that tries to explain where mind came from, and it's just not there. So if there's not an intelligent God that made man's mind and man's intelligence, then where could this possibly have come from? The only possible explanation is that there is a being with a mind who has managed to create this universe. The universe is in perfect order, and every 19 years we find that the universe comes back to exactly the same place it was 19 years before. Well, how did all this get into control from this Big Bang that men imagine? Well, a Big Bang is just going to send everything everywhere. There's no order to an explosion. But there's perfect order to the universe, and there's perfect order in many things on the earth called life. And there's many things that testify that they are living. And where did life come from? Man has tried in many ways that he can to try to create life. And if man with all his intelligence today is not able to create life, who did? So Christians are not ignorant people that just accept anything they're told. Christians check out and try to find if these things are so. So someone says, well, what about the Bible? Somebody wrote it about 300 BC, or sorry, AD. And we're saying, well, would you like to prove that? And of course they can't. But what we can prove is that we have the Dead Sea Scrolls, where many of these books of the Bible are found as far back as 400 BC. And those are copies of these things in that history. So We're looking now at a man called Josephus, and he's not a Christian as far as the world is concerned. And he lived at the time of Christ, and he was a secretary for the general who destroyed Jerusalem. His name is Titus. His father's Vespasian, who turned out to be emperor. Vespasian brought the army in 68 AD, and then he was made emperor. Titus then took over from his father, and Josephus then, in the destruction of Jerusalem, sat down and was taking a dictation from Josephus, from Titus, to tell what happened. So then they gave him the job afterward of writing the history of the Jews. They hired him in Rome. Well, here's what Josephus wrote. And we have this in Antiquities, and it's found in all manuscripts that are copies of Josephus' letter. And we have hundreds in different languages, all written from different times. And most of them agree. But in all the manuscripts, you have these words. He said, James, the brother of Jesus, and he refers to the stoning of James, by order of Ananus, Ben Ananus, Herodian era high priest. The James referred to in this passage is most likely the James to whom the epistle of James has been attributed. So the translations of Josephus written in other language have at times included passages that are not found in the Greek, but this one's found in all of them. Okay, here's his witness. So he assembled, this is book 20, chapter 9, part 1. So he assembled the Sanhedrin of judges and brought before them the brother of Jesus, who was called Christ, whose name was James, and some others, or some of his companions. And when he had formed an accusation against them as breakers of the law, he delivered them to be stoned. So here Josephus testifies, the brother of Jesus, and he identifies this brother of Jesus. His name is James, and Jesus was called Christ. Now, in some of these that are repeated in the literature that we find in different media, they add the word so-called, but it's not in any of the copies in the Greek or any of the other languages. They just put in so-called. Well, he says, who is called Christ. All right, then we have the next one here, Josephus' quote, and this is in book 18, chapter 3, part 3. Now there arose at this time a source of further trouble in one Jesus, a wise man who performed surprising work, a teacher of men who gladly welcomed strange things. He led away many Jews and also many of the Gentiles. He was so-called Christ. When Pilate, acting on information, supplied by the chief men around us, condemned him to the cross, those who had attached themselves to him at first did not cease to cause trouble, and the tribe of Christians, which was taken from this name from him, is not extinct today. All right, there's one translation from a media. All right, here's another translation, and this is by cell.org. And there was about this time Jesus, a wise man, if it be lawful to call him a wise man. And by the way, this fits the Greek. For he was a doer of wonderful works, a teacher of men, as received the truth with pleasure. He drew over to him both many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day. As the divine prophets had foretold, these and 10,000 other wonderful things concerning him, and the tribe of Christians, so named from him, are not extinct at this day. Let me reread some of that again. He drew to him many of the Jews and many of the Gentiles. He was Christ. And when Pilate, at the suggestion of the principal men amongst us, had condemned him to the cross, those that loved him at the first did not forsake him, for he appeared to them alive again the third day, as the divine prophets had foretold. Well, they say, well, Christians wrote that. The problem is it's found in all of the different manuscripts. And so testimony that Josephus gives is very strong. Then we have Suetonius, who was a Roman historian that said Christianity was a very strange thing. He testified to Christ that did wonderful works. Tacitus again lived during this time, and he bore witness the same as Suetonius. Then Pliny testified that he was killing Christians and didn't really know why. Then the emperor Trajan wrote to Pliny and said, you're doing right, keep on doing what you're doing, even though we don't know anything against them, just their obstinance in not denying Christ is enough for them to be killed. And then we have others testifying to Christ. And Ignatius was another one, and Ignatius wrote a book. He lived from 59 AD through 108, and he wrote several books and included almost all the books of the New Testament, and he wrote it during the first century. So what does that tell us then about all these people that say that the scriptures were not written till the second or third century? Then there's a book called, Clement of Rome. And the problem is Clement's name is not in the book. It's tradition that gives the name Clement. But what's in the book is the Church of Rome writing to the Church of Corinth. And in this book, which is written before Christ, and we have many witnesses, he also describes almost every book and quotes from almost every book in the New Testament. I've got a list of that if anybody wants to see it, all the books. So how can anybody say that the New Testament books, all 27, were not written during the first century, as Christians have said for years? So there's no reason for us to deny all these witnesses. Someone says, well, I still don't believe it. What reason would we have for not believing eyewitnesses? These people lived during that time. And then we have many other witnesses of the same way. Then we have the books of the Bible. We've got 5,000 different copies of different parts of the New Testament. And according to the critics that say the Bible was not written until the third century, they say that all 5,800 are so much the same that we just count them as one book. And then when you ask them, well, which book do you take? They say, well, we find this 200 over here called the Alexandrian text. And we say, well, they all differ. They say, yeah, but we can find the truth from all these 200. We're saying, why don't you take the 5,800 witnesses? They say, well, they just all agree and we can't take them. They have no reason for rejecting them, but they conclude the Bible was not written during the first century. Well, in Daniel, the book of Daniel, the Lord testifies that there's going to be a kingdom that's established, and that kingdom is going to be established throughout the earth. Daniel, the second chapter, and starting in verse 32, Nebuchadnezzar has a dream. Starting in verse 28, but there is a God of heaven that reveals secrets and makes known to the king Nebuchadnezzar what shall be in the latter days. Thy dream and the visions of thy head upon thy bed are these. As for thee, O king, thy thoughts came into thy mind upon thy bed. What shall come to pass hereafter, and he that reveals secrets make known to thee what shall come to pass. But as for me, this secret is not revealed to me for any wisdom that I have more than any living, but for their sake, which shall make known the interpretation to the king, and that thou mightst know the thoughts of thy heart. Thou, O king, sawest and behold a great image. The great image, whose brightness was excellent, stood before thee, and the form thereof was terrible. The image's head was of fine gold, his breast, his arms of silver, his belly, thighs of brass, his legs of iron, his feet part of iron and part of clay. Thou sawest till that a stone was cut out without hands, which smote the image upon his feet that were of the iron and clay, and brake them in pieces. Then was the iron, the clasp, the the clay, the brass, the silver, and the gold broke into pieces together and became like the chaff of the summer threshing floors. And the wind carried them away that no place was found for them. And the stone that smote them became an image, a great image, a great mountain, and filled the whole earth. This is the dream, and we will tell the interpretation of before the king. Thou, O king, art a king of kings. For the God of heaven shall give thee a kingdom, power, and strength, and glory. And wheresoever the children of men dwell, the beasts of the field, the fowls of the heaven, hath he given into thine hand, and hath made thee ruler over them all. For thou art this head of gold. And after thee shall arise another kingdom inferior to thee, and another third kingdom of brass, which shall bear rule over all the earth. So here are three world-ruling kingdoms. And the fourth kingdom shall be strong as iron, for as much as iron breaks in pieces and subdues all things, and as iron that breaks all these, shall it break in pieces and bruise. And whereas thou sawest the feet and toes, part of potter's clay and part of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, but there shall be in it the strength of iron, for as much as thou sawest the iron mixed with miry clay. As the toes of the feet were part of iron, part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. And whereas thou sawest iron mixed with clay, miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men, but they shall not cleave one to another, even as iron is not mixed with clay. All right, here it is. In the days of these kings shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. For as much as thou sawest that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, that it break in pieces, the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation thereof sure. So here we see a prophecy concerning four world-ruling kingdoms. And turn to Daniel, the 8th chapter. And Daniel has a vision here that incorporates two different kingdoms. And we see that he names the next two kingdoms that would rule the world. In the third year, verse 1, chapter 8, of the reign of King Belshazzar, that'd be 536 B.C., a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. And I saw in a vision, it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan the palace, which is in the province of Elam. I saw in a vision, I was by the river Ulai. Then I lift up my eyes and saw, behold, there stood before the river a ram that had two horns. And the two horns were high, one higher than the other, the higher came up last. I saw the ram pushing westward, northward, and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand. But he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. He came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen there, which had there seen standing before the river, and ran upon him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with cholera against him, and smote the ram, and broke his two horns. And there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped on him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Therefore the he-goat waxed very great when he was strong. The great horn was broken, for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great toward the south, toward the east, toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and the stars and stamped upon them. Yet he magnified himself even to the prince of the host. And by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, it practiced and prospered. All right, he continues on describing all this in verse 15. It came to pass that when I, even I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, then behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid and fell on my face. But he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now, as I was speaking with him, I was in deep sleep on my face toward the ground. But he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, for at the time appointed the end shall be. The ram which you saw, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. And the rough goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up for out of the nation, but not in his power. So notice now, he's prophesying two nations that will come, calls the name of them, and describe what's going to happen in this last kingdom. And we know that after Babylon came the Medes and Persians, then they ruled for 200 years, then Greece came, and the first horn, of course, was Alexander the Great, and then his kingdom was broken up into four parts, and then Daniel 9 and 10 describes how these kingdoms then would fight with each other. In Daniel, the ninth chapter, this is the first year of Darius. That's the king of the Medes. King of the Medes. And Daniel then had a dream, and he didn't understand it. So Gabriel here is sent. Again, he's praying to the Lord and asking the Lord for understanding concerning this vision. And as he prays, starting in verse 20, while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God for the holy mountain of my God, yea, while I was speaking in prayer, even the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at the beginning, being caused to fly swiftly, touched me about the time of the evening oblation. And he informed me and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I am now come forth to give thee skill and understanding. All right, so he begins to interpret this, verse 24. 70 weeks are determined upon thy people, upon the holy city, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make reconciliation for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy. Know therefore and understand that from the going forth of the commandment to restore and build Jerusalem, that was 536 BC, the prince shall be, 444 BC. The prince shall be 7 weeks, and 62 weeks the street shall be built again, and the wall even in troublous time. After 62 weeks shall Messiah be cut off, but not for himself. And the people of the prince that shall come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary, and the end shall be with a flood. And unto the end of the war, desolations are determined. And he shall confirm the covenant with many for 1 week, and the midst of the week he shall cause his sacrifice and oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of abomination, he shall make it desolate, even unto the consummation, and that determined shall be poured upon the desolate. So when Christ came and John the Baptist, they were preaching, the kingdom is at hand. Well, this is the kingdom he was talking about. And here he tells Messiah will be anointed, and we know who the Messiah is. Then the Messiah shall be cut off, but not for himself. Then they will destroy the city and the sanctuary. We know that Daniel, the copy of Daniel, was at least 300 BC. So 370 years later, all this begins to transpire and take place. What could possibly be that would interpret this dream and prophesy the future so accurately? Then the Lord said this kingdom would never be destroyed. Let's close with 2 Corinthians chapter 4. Verses 16 to 18. For the which cause we faint not, but though our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed by day. For our affliction is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things which are not seen are eternal. Those who study the New Testament know that the church is the kingdom, and the kingdom and the church are spiritual, and that these things will last forever. God has prophesied concerning this, and when we die, we're still in that kingdom. And Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you, that where I am, there you may be also. So all these things God has testified to in his scripture, foretelling future and also giving witnesses, six witnesses or more to Christ's miracles. And these people all agree in their witness. So the question is, on what right would anyone deny that the scriptures are from God, prophesied by God, and inspired by God? And everything that he prophesied has come to take place. So are Christians just bland people that believe anything? No, we check all these things out. We don't want to follow something that's not true. So anyone who gives us evidence, we check it out. And we know there is an eternal master in heaven. His name is Jesus Christ. And we know that there is an eternal God who sent Christ to give us the truth and make a covenant. And that covenant is called the New Testament, which in Greek is the same word as covenant. And if we keep this covenant, God has made a promise that we will have eternal life. And this great God is still alive, still doing all these marvelous things, working all things together after the counsel of his own will. And he's created us and this world for his purpose. We need to find that purpose and fulfill his purpose for creating us. We'll have the closing hymn now.